dog and officially radio's best friend.
The following is a special CJSF presentation that interrupts regularly scheduled programming in this time slot.
I believe in living.
I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people.
I believe in sunshine and windmills and waterfalls, tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees.
I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes.
I believe in rain and tears and in the blood of infinity. I believe in life.
I believe in life. And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth.
Sculpting mud bodies in this path. I've seen the destruction of the daylight.
And seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind.
And the blind become the bind.
In one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass. I have eaten crow and blunder bread and breathed the stench of indifference.
I've been locked by the lawless. Handcuffed by the haters, gagged by the greedy. And if I know anything at all,
it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all.
It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth.
I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship, steered by tired, seasick sailors,
can still be guided home to port.
This program is part 6 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided. Part 6 focuses on borders, race, and multiculturalism. This program is dedicated to Palestinian freedom and the liberation of indigenous people everywhere.
Can you keep on moving unless you migrate too? They tell you to keep on moving, but migrate you must not do. The only reason for moving and the reason why I roam, to move to a new location and find myself a home.
My name is Ilaria Giglioli. I am a professor of international studies at the University of San Francisco. I'm a geographer, actually, by training, and I've been working on migration and borders issues for over a decade, and mainly in the Mediterranean, now currently also to some extent on the U.S.-Mexico border as well. I teach a variety of classes, but specifically migration related. I now teach a sort of global course focused primarily on borders, but also migration for our master's program, which is mainly more in the field of critical border or migration studies. So really kind of questioning or understanding, you know, causes of displacement, also sort of causes of increased bordering around the world. And sort of looking at this both from the perspective, from a more practical and applied perspective of what should be done to accommodate the situation, but also more broadly from a sort of broader conceptual theoretical standpoint, you know, really questioning the way that we think about borders and migration. Everything that I talk about is really precisely this, that we're so embedded in this assumption that, you know, the nation state is the default way that we should organize society, right? So that we can talk about processes of inclusion or exclusion, and we can talk about, you know, which borders be open or closed, but we always sort of start from this assumption that they're there. And I think one of the key things for me in my own teaching and other work is really questioning this, and, you know, not just abstractly and theoretically, but also just looking back historically and understanding, you know, at what moment do borders become significant, And also borders as, you know, as a sort of key area that cannot be crossed, right? So at what moment we start seeing right of mobility, international mobility be a question? Like right now, generally, I would say globally, there's an understanding that limiting people's freedom of movement within the nation state is a big violation of their human rights. And even the International Declaration of Human Rights, you know, talks about the right to mobility, but within the borders of the nation state. And so I think one of the things I start really questioning is how do we come to this assumption that you know, limiting people's freedom of movement within the nation state is a problem, but internationally it's accepted, right? So I definitely always try to start from this point of view. Actually, one of the things I always talk about is precisely this, you know, the sort of invention of the passport. When did the passport that we take for granted become the instrument that you need? And it's really, you know, century and a half that that's been the case. One question I always pose to my students in my classes is, there's an assumption that you don't work against any kind of form of discrimination on the basis of, for example, gender, race, sexuality, whatever. But when it comes to nationality, we sort of accept that, right? That different people can have a different right of mobility according to their nationality. And I always pose the question, do you think this is a form of discrimination or not? And it's interesting to hear the debates. There's always a lot of debate around that question. But I think it's a real question that I want to pose. Why do we accept that? And of course, we can go and have a broader discussion about geopolitics and all of that. But I think it just at a sort of very basic principle, I always try to push back on, one, the assumption that borders are natural and normal, that the nation state is the default form of social organization that we should always live with, we always will live with, and also, three, the sort of normal and natural to have differentiated right of mobility according to one's nationality. And I think so many times in discussions about migration, it's so easy to sort of abstract to a very broad level and abstract from the lived experience and just talk about numbers. But I think at another level, just really understanding, especially for people that are based in the global north and have passports with a lot of power, just understand what it means to not be able to move freely. Of course, in the more extreme cases, right, of forced displacement, but also just on a very day-to-day level, just not having the possibility of travel. We've just seen fortification of border walls globally really ramp up really from the early 2000s, but already in the 90s, right? So it's this moment which is supposed to be the moment, a symbolic moment of, you know, coming down of walls. I remember, you know, I was probably something about how old I am, but I remember I was I think in preschool at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I remember our teacher was telling us the story about this fall, and it was so bad and it would separate, you know, and there was this thing, this image, I grew up in Italy, so, you know, this idea that it was going to separate you from your grandparents, you know, all these walls and you couldn't go and see your grandparents. I don't know why this image just stayed in my mind, you know, but this idea, oh, and that's finished. And of course, we've seen the absolute opposite happen. We sometimes have this dichotomy of, okay, there's the false borders created in formerly colonized countries, right? In a sense, and that's the cause of a lot of displacement. Absolutely true. At the same time, I think that dichotomy sometimes then makes us assume that there are contexts in which borders are normal or natural. And that's something I push back against, because I would say, you know, even in countries that we are sort of the prototype of the nation state from a Eurocentric perspective, perhaps, but like something like France, right? Well, actually, there was a whole process of internal colonization that happened there as well. In Italy, absolute same exact thing, processes of internal colonialism. The UK, I mean, all these places had their own processes. So in that sense, well, absolutely, I agree that, you know, European colonialism did create borders, breaking apart, you know, populations with a long history of interconnection, and created all sorts of ethnic conflicts that are still persistent today. I push back against the idea that there are natural borders and less natural borders, because I think that kind of goes back to the idea that it can be normal and natural in some space. And I think one thing we've seen is that nationalism is a very strong, you know, vehicle for people to make meaning out of, and I think connect their identity to. So, I mean, the question here is, I think there's two separate things. One is, how do people make meaning out of belonging? And we have to question ideas of nationalism overall. And this question comes up very often in the classes that I teach sometimes when I talk about anti-colonial nationalisms. And, you know, if we're critiquing nationalism, what does it mean when you have a national, you know, nationalism was a vehicle for a movement that was sort of dealing with, was a movement that was sort of pushing for decolonization, we still present the same critiques towards that kind of nationalism or not. That's why you have to be careful about creating a blanket statement. How was the idea of the nation mobilized, for what means, etc. Of course, you know, we see there's all sorts of problems with anti-colonial nationalisms. One thing is you want to identify with that group as an important vehicle of meaning making, that's fine. The other question is who can or cannot belong to that nation state, right? And that's the key question. And I think another thing that comes up often is understanding of who belongs to the nation is something that is mobile and changing. And you can perhaps imagine this in an expansive sense that's not as exclusionary as many forms of contemporary nationalism are. And I also think another thing is also, does that sense of national identity have to go hand in hand with closed borders, with fortified borders? And I see the main problem in my perspective of certain forms of nationalism is when they translate into forms of material and symbolic exclusion. So essentially, this is something that comes out of some research that I have done in parts of Southern Europe, specifically in my case in Sicily, in the south of Italy, that embrace a rhetoric that's very different from the kinds of nationalisms that we see emerging globally, and particularly in parts of Europe that, you know, have a sort of very defined boundary of the nation state. So these are places in which sort of even the sort of official celebrations of the local identity are about mixing and interconnection, sort of connections across the border. In this case that I'm talking about, you know, is connections between Southern Europe and North Africa, you know, one of the most fortified borders globally. I think the point that I'm trying to make in my research is that essentially, when you're looking at celebrations of multiculturalism, you have to look beyond the rhetoric, right? So what are the power relations at play in this context? Is this a sort of, what are the material inequalities between different groups look like in this context? Do these sort of celebrations of multiculturalism talk about substantive access to opportunities for different populations, particularly for racialized populations in this context? And often there's a sort of, there's celebrations of multiculturalism that basically kind of cherry pick certain palatable aspects of a sort of marginalized or racialized population and celebrate them without questioning either, you know, the hegemonic or social organization, without questioning power relations between different groups, etc. So that's really what I'm getting at, right? And I'm saying that in that sense, in the context of Southern Europe, specifically of Sicily, that I study, and actually even in some historical forms or kind of colonial celebrations of multiculturalism, what you have is essentially a sort of just very superficial, aestheticized celebration of difference without addressing and even power relations in place. So it's not a critique of multiculturalism overall. It's a critique of, going back to the question of nationalism as well, it's a question of understand where the power relations like. I definitely want to look towards a world without fortified and closed borders. That's definitely a goal that I see. Borders overall, I think, I hesitate to 100% take a no borders perspective, once again, because it depends on the context, depends on the sort of geopolitical balance or broader questions like that. And I think in some cases, there are some fears, but in certain contexts about being incorporated into the strength of other broader, more stronger hegemonic powers kind of putting their hands on a specific context. And so I think that's why I'm hesitant to sort of go absolutely no borders, but I'm definitely would want to see non-fortified, non-militarized borders, and I would like to see freedom of movement. There's been arguments that essentially a freer circulation of people would, to some extent, equalize labor conditions in different parts of the world. There's an argument for that. And so there's an argument that essentially more freedom of movement, it would essentially lead to a sort of surge in migration initially, and then probably it would even out. And there have been studies that have done specifically looking at what happened between Eastern and Western Europe in that case specifically. I think broader fears about loss of cultural identity, if you want to call that broadly, which is another big fear that come up. There, I guess I would just push back more generally on the question that there is such a thing as an immobile culture in Mobile Nation, and so just sort of explain that as a natural process. But I do think that a lot of the current anxiety around migration and borders, a lot of the rising nationalisms, I see this as really a fallout in terms of, you know, neoliberalization of the economy that's happened worldwide, and especially in a lot of countries of the global north. These are really sort of, to a large part, I would argue, their economic anxieties. It's interesting, right? So climate migration is something that we hear, there's a lot about, right? And of course, it's important, it's significant. You know, climate change is having impacts on people's lives and livelihoods worldwide. And then what about all those people, right? Because then normally, you know, you think they're economically classified as economic migrants for most of the world. If climate erodes your livelihood, it's still a difficult argument to make that you're a forced migrant. I mean, in talking international law, right, and things like that. So in that sense, I think that a lot of climate migration is going to be maybe less of the type of kind of catastrophic, of course, that also exists, hurricanes, floods, et cetera, but like that's going to be minor as opposed to sort of erosions of livelihoods for climate-related reasons.
My name is Leila Awadullah. I am a Palestinian-American choreographer and dancer artist based primarily in Minneapolis, Minnesota Makoche, the land of Dakota and Ojibwe peoples. Yeah, originally born to a Palestinian father and American mother, American Sicilian mother in South Dakota. I've spent my past recent years as an artist really developing my voice between living in Beirut and Minneapolis. That's another important part of the context which I've been working and making work is being in Lebanon and working with Palestinian communities there and a bit in Palestine as well. I have a dance project called Badi Watani. It's a new project, and Badi Watani is kind of a research on the question of homeland in the body. Watani means my homeland in Arabic and is often a word used in Palestinian poetry and stories to resemble not just like the homeland, but like the soul of your land. Like the it has an indigenous ring and essence to relationship to place. We were, you know, a group of artists asking the question, what do our body homelands remember in relationship to the Mediterranean Sea? And that came up 3, 4, 5 years ago when I was feeling pretty overwhelmed and distraught about the loss of life in the Mediterranean, which is still ongoing. And there's, you know, it's such a long story. But to me, I just didn't know how to feel that grief. I was doing a residency in southern France by the sea and just never really being able to dance because I was so overcome with just this thought that the sea was like a graveyard. And so Terrania, the performance, came from this question of like, what would it be if the Mediterranean landscapes were as fluid as the water? And what would it mean if the people of the Mediterranean could move freely and that they would, you know, welcome each other to each other's homes? Yeah, it was kind of like a dream, a vision of a time that already had existed, not to romanticize or put this utopia kind of sense on it, but just to say like, there's so much grief in the Mediterranean, there's so much loss, and to find a story of like a mythology. So then we started writing the mythology, me and a collaborator from Beirut, to create this spirit that lived in the sea named Terrania. And Terrania basically would gather all the lost souls or all the lost stories in the Mediterranean and hold them in her body. And so she became the record of anything lost at sea, of anybody, of any story, and all the people who drown or who were lost at sea could meet within her body and then share these stories and songs and live another fluid life, a fluid context. And then me and my sister, as Palestinian artists who really use our work to talk about Palestine, we were also coming with the lens of like, this happens on the shores of Palestine. It's a Mediterranean story, but it happens on the shores of Palestine. So then, you know, we have a choreography about the occupation and the block on your body. And we were just in this square going around and around and around, unable to crack it open until we went to this point of like what we called the rupture. And the rupture is when the forces on the body that are more earthly gravitational forces just bind you, block you. And then the rupture happens and the land starts to spill. And then we kind of made this choreography of imagining our bodies as landscapes rolling, which then kind of led us through, yeah, like a dream state of stories that eventually bring us to the sea. And in the performance, we take this moment of meeting the sea and trying to survive and trying to stay above water. And we end up drowning. Like in the vision of the work, we drown and sink down. And that's when the local dancers or the guest dancers, we call the second wave, come in. And this, when we toured this work, every city we would have a process, a creative process with local dancers and kind of meet their water and their stories so that when we sink to the bottom in the work, we're actually suddenly held by what we imagine as ancestors who are ready, who are there and ready to hold us. And we meet all together and our collective blurs. Every city had a different ending based on the conversation in the room, based on the people who entered the space. The other thing I'll say about the elements of Terrania is I spent a lot of time researching and swimming in the Mediterranean off the coast of Lebanon. So I filmed a lot of like the underwater spaces and used that in the projection of the performance. So it was all my own footage that I kind of turned upside down to create more abstracted images of waterscapes. And then the musician, Renee Copeland, or she's the composer, her and I went to Sicily together to gather sounds of the water, throwing microphones into the sea, gathering songs from like Sicilian fishing songs are in the work. And then we worked with Amal Kawash, who's a Palestinian refugee artist based in Lebanon, who was singing, kind of reimagining really specific folk songs of Palestinian culture and like kind of weaving them into the context of this work. So Amal and I spent also like a year talking about what songs would be right and why and where, and searching for songs about the sea and songs about the land. And so there were many, many collaborators, many landscapes that created Terrania. So I feel very much like released from being like any kind, like I am only the initiator and the gatherer, but it really became a work of so many people over, 3 to 4 years. Because the whole Terrania is all about the politics of movement, whose bodies are allowed and where and why. In the Palestinian context, like I feel like as a choreographer, it's kind of an obsession of mine to think, I mean, because the occupation is a choreography, it's a violent choreography. It says these bodies can move this way at this time with this, and these bodies can move this way. And some bodies are allowed to move more freely than others. And why, you know, and what does that mean? And what does that do to someone's body to like not be able to go and return freely from their land? And I worked a lot with, so much with refugee Palestinian people in Lebanon who can just look over and say, that's our land, but we can't go. And it's just something that I think then as a choreographer, I have to think about the politics of movement in that region, who's allowed to go and not, and why. And as an American passport holder, also, I feel like I hold two extremes in my heart, which is, or not my heart really, the reality that I can use an American passport, which is one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful passport on earth, in a kind of way that disgusts me. And then the Palestinian passport, or the Palestinian reality, is the extreme opposite. I've been 3 times to Palestine in the past 8 years. And the first time I went, what surprised me about the wall, in my imagination, it was a straight line that divided place. But actually, it's so curvy. And there's where my family lives in the Bethlehem area, there's Checkpoint 300, which is kind of a well-known checkpoint because a lot of violence has happened there. And the wall near that checkpoint like curves around a house like a snake. It's like you see it go up to this house, and then it goes around this house, and then it goes back and keeps going. And so to me, when I saw that, I learned that the wall, it's not just like, yeah, like this border, it's like slurping up. Like it feels like a snake that grabs, you know, a little more here, a little more there. I also saw that it looks different on one side versus the other. On the side of the West Bank, it's big concrete slabs that are covered in graffiti. And, you know, they look really just, they look like they shouldn't be there. And then when you're on the side of, you know, what they call Israel, the Israeli state, the wall looks cleaner. It blends in more. And even in Hebron and El Khalil, the checkpoint from the Palestinian side looks like a cage. And then from the Israeli side, it looks like there's, you know, plants and it's smooth. So it just feels like it's hidden in plain sight. And then even they draw lines on the water. They draw lines on the international, this is international water and this is our water. It makes no sense, but they're there. And fishermen in Gaza get shot if they cross a certain line in the water, in the sea that you can't see. And if there's stories of this, so, I mean, that's such a ridiculous human invention. Like, think of the birds. You can just see them go migrate across. Like, so many birds and butterflies are just moving across space. And we humans have just made all these boundaries on each other and on ourselves. I mean, borders are a recent invention. They haven't been here forever. And still there has been identity, cultural identity, relationship to landscape and place and shared values without the lines. That has existed. And so what if we identified through water rather than land? What if, like, because I live on the Mississippi in Minneapolis, like, what if the Mississippi people were actually like, that was our identity in this part of the world? And how would we see ourselves in relation if we were the Mississippi people? And we saw where we, you know, started the headwaters, you know, all the way to the tributaries, like, what would that do? In my experiences as an artist, I feel like the ripples between people and ideas and emotions and relations get thicker and stronger and more nuanced and more powerful through art. I feel that we can transmit ideas and place, and we can move a lot of energy and build a lot of relationships in the immediate surroundings of the work. Since October 7th, I don't know, it's been really hard to think about what kind of art do you make right now that does anything. Like, there's a moment when you feel like it's all just for show, or like it happens and it disappears and it doesn't change or stop a genocide. It doesn't give anyone you feel like it doesn't give anyone water or food or stop violence. And you can't really, I mean, in some ways, yeah, it feels like, what do you create? Like, that could hold this right now. That's how I have felt in moments. And then at the same time, I still have been in working creatively, because that's my livelihood.